Well, there's always plenty of work for the Attorney General of any state. The AG's office is in a unique place, giving legal advice to state agencies and working to protect the people of the state at the same time, so seldom a dull moment. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum is visiting the Rogue Valley at the moment. That puts her here in the studio with us for the first time. So, Ellen Rosenblum, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be down in Southern Oregon and to be here.
What is the event that brings you down here?
Well, I was invited by a wonderful group of lawyers and judges to speak to their professional organization last night over at the Roxy Ann Winery. And this is called the Inn of Court, the American Inns of Court. And it's just a fabulous group. It's headed up by Judge Gerking here in Medford in Jackson County, Judge Clark, Magistrate Judge Clark, Judge Panner was there. So lots of my old friends and about 70 lawyers, local lawyers, and their spouses and friends.
I see you were a trial and appellate judge yourself, weren't you, in addition to a former federal prosecutor.
Exactly. Yeah. And I should have added that we also have offices. The Department of Justice has two offices here in Medford, not here in Ashland. But we have a child support office, and we also have a child advocacy office that does our protective services work here in the Four County area.
Now, one of the issues in front of you is a lawsuit against defendants in White City in Jackson County. This is the alleged magazine scam. What can you tell us about that?
We just filed a 46-page complaint. We filed it in Marion County, but guess where the scam was headquartered? Right in White City, Oregon. And on the map, as you all know, it's not very far from here. We have sued a large group of companies, about 19 companies, 9 individuals, for a huge magazine subscription scam headquartered right here in the Valley, basically ripping off thousands of people for millions of dollars all across the country, people who thought they were dealing with legitimate subscriptions, discovered that, in fact, their prices were inflated. They were being asked to sign on for long-term subscriptions, some of which would probably have expired after their death, since many of them were senior citizens. It's a huge scam. Of course, we've just filed the complaint, so nothing's been formally proven yet. But we have a 46-page complaint charging unlawful trade practices and violations of the racketeering laws of Oregon.
Did it take a while to get a hold of these folks and get the complaint in order? I know that one of the magazines I subscribe to has been warning for, it seems like, a couple of years now,
right,
about avoid these the names of these businesses in Jackson County,
yeah,
Oregon.
Yeah, it's taken a long time to get this together, but we finally have a really, I think, very robust group working on this, and we have some fabulous lawyers at the Department of Justice and throughout the country, including New York, 4 or 5 other states that we're working with, and we think that we're going to have a very successful lawsuit. We've already been able to freeze their bank accounts, and we're very hopeful that we'll be able to get money back for people who should not have paid what they did, extremely inflated subscription prices for magazines, newspapers, and such.
Ellen Rosenblum, you recently asked the legislature for an elder abuse prosecutor. Why do you feel like such a position is needed?
We have a huge problem in this state and throughout the country with regard to elder financial abuse. In fact, I was just talking about it in connection with this scam. Elder folks are generally more susceptible, not the only ones, to scammers. And so we feel that there's a strong need to be able to take action to bring people to account who scam our senior citizens. Sadly, often it includes family members. These are folks who are extremely vulnerable, who are living in situations where their money becomes accessible to family, and of course, in a very trusting, gullible individuals who have lived their lives well, have accumulated retirement funds, and they can be just taken away in the snap of a finger by a family member or by a bad guy out there. So we are asking for a statewide elder abuse resource prosecutor, similar to 2 other resource prosecutors that have been very successful at the Department of Justice, because we're able to help law enforcement and DAs throughout the state to bring these cases that can be very complex. They can involve lots of documents, lots of technical, analytical work that simply can't be done in some of these, especially rural counties where there aren't resources. So if we can get that prosecutor on board, I guarantee you we're going to be able to have more success at protecting our vulnerable senior citizens.
Would the cases then initiate in the counties then be handed off to the resource prosecutor? Or
just the opposite, actually. Our resource prosecutor will be helping to get things set up so that they can be brought in the counties, perhaps even occasionally serving as a prosecutor if requested, but primarily providing training, providing resources. We'll also, if successful, have 2 investigators who can assist, because without the investigators, frankly, you really can't do the work. Prosecutors are great, but they're lawyers, and the investigators can crunch the numbers and help to make the case.
Ellen Rosenblum is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Attorney General of the State of Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions and comments go to 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. A couple of things that your department has requested from the legislature. One of them is House Bill 3476, confidentiality for people asking for services from sexual assault or domestic violence advocates, which raises the question, really, that confidentiality is not there now?
It's not there for certain types of communications. And that includes currently there is no confidentiality when a student or another individual who's been harmed either by sexual assault, by other types of domestic violence or stalking, for example, go to speak to an advocate for counseling, for support, for advocacy. So a victim's advocate conversation currently is not confidentially protected by Oregon law. That's what we're asking for. 40 other states have this type of confidentiality. 8 states have a complete privilege, if you will, and that's what we're asking for. So that, let's just say, the unfortunately epidemic situation of campus sexual assault now results in a young person going to see a victim advocate the next day or perhaps the next week for help. That conversation right now, there is simply no guarantee of confidentiality. And under Title IX, which is a federal law, that information must be provided to the university in order to pursue administrative proceedings against the perpetrator. The problem is that, guess what? People just simply, victims just simply are not willing to report under those circumstances. And so we have a real problem with reporting. We believe that if this law passes, you will see an uptick in the number of reports of these incidents of sexual assault on campus and other incidents of domestic violence.
I was going to ask you if Title IX was part of the issue here, because I know at Southern Oregon University and a couple of other campuses, do they have confidential student advisors who are apparently outside of the Title IX world and they don't have to report within that university system?
There may be some, but for the most part on college campuses, there's no guarantee of that. And at least students believe that when they go to see, currently believe that when they go to see a victim's advocate, and by that I mean someone who's not got, for example, a PhD psychology degree. In that case, you might already have that privilege and probably do. But most of the advocates do not have that sort of degree. So what we'll be doing is the Attorney General's office will be providing a certification of at least 40 hours of training. We don't do the training, but we'll make sure that the person is properly certified. And once they are, then they essentially fall into that privilege category. And that will allow for these communications, these conversations, for once and for all to be private.
Ellen Rosenblum is the Attorney General of the State of Oregon and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join the conversation here. 800-838-3760, our phone number across the listening area, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, I see also in the legislature you're working for Senate Bill 188, the so-called revenge porn bill.
Yes.
It passed 29 to nothing in the Senate, which is a pretty good idea of the support you have there. What would the bill
right.
do?
Right. Well, revenge porn is kind of a term that I don't really like too much, but basically what it means is the unlawful dissemination of intimate images. Now, if you have an intimate image online that you've given consent to, that's one thing. But let's say you break up with your boyfriend, and your ex-boyfriend decides that as a form of revenge to disseminate those images to others, either publicly or to friends or whomever, that would become a crime, and that will become a crime.
How tricky is it to write such legislation, though, particularly when it comes to define? And believe me, anybody who's ever read a bill knows that there's usually a big section at the top with definitions. So how do you define, for example, intimate image?
Right. Well, we've tried to do our best, and it's taken a while because, of course, whenever you're talking about just about anything online, you have First Amendment issues, you have all sorts of issues that require, you know, parsing of words. And then, of course, you have the elements of the charge, you bring the case, and then you've got the courts to deal with in terms of any interpretation of the words. So I think all I can tell you is we've done our best to define the terms. I think it's kind of a no, you know it when you see it sort of deal when it comes to intimate images, frankly.
Okay. So, but one way or the other, it's a little surprising that some of this hasn't already been outlawed, but we discover lots of new things as the world becomes more linked electronically.
You have to remember that, technology is changing day to day. And so this sort of conduct just didn't happen in the past because we didn't have the technology to do it. Now it's just the click of the phone or whatever your gadget happens to be.
And on that same sort of general realm, 20, 25 years ago, we didn't have big fights about what emails could not become public. There was the whole ongoing issue starting with the late Kitzhaber administration, the former governor, and the emails of the former governor and his first lady, Sylvia Hayes, and what could not become public. You were forced to weigh in there a time or two on this, and I believe you decided to make some of the Sylvia Hayes emails public. Is that correct?
Yes, I made a ruling that that she's a public figure or public official, excuse me, and which is essentially the same thing. And because of that, even her private emails need to be reviewed because they may well include public official types of communications. She's appealing that. She doesn't agree, and so at the moment, her private emails have not been disclosed, but 94,000 emails have been disclosed that were on the government system that involved Ms. Hayes. And so given that her name showed up on that many emails, one would wonder how it could be possible that she doesn't qualify as a public official. We'll see what the courts do with that. That matter is on appeal.
Well, it seems like between this and Hillary Clinton at the federal level as well, when she was Secretary of State, there's the issue of is it my email? Is it personal email? Was it a state email account that Sylvia Hayes was using that she was trying to protect?
She was using a personal email account. But as I said, there also were many emails that were sent on government email that went to that where she was either copied or where she was a party to the email. So it's kind of a combination. But the ones that we ruled on pertain to her private email accounts, or at least her allegedly private email accounts, but where she did most of her public business.
So beyond the personality of Sylvia Hayes and the circumstances there, I mean, where do lines get drawn about public access to public emails? I mean, are we defaulting to public at this point? Are we defaulting to protected unless needed to be public? I mean, where is that line being drawn?
Well, I'm not exactly sure that I understand your question, but I will tell you that if a matter involves public activities and it's on email, then it really doesn't matter whether it's a public email system or a private email system. And so people really need to be aware of that, including, all the way from Sylvia Hayes to perhaps Hillary Clinton. There are concerns that if you use your private email, you need to be aware that if you're using it for a public purpose, that it really isn't private.
All right, so this is kind of the thing that everybody needs to remember. If you're doing any business on an email account, it becomes...
Exactly, and that includes me.
You too, okay.
You bet, absolutely. All of us who are public officials, we all have to be very much aware of what is public and what is private. And where you draw that line can be a gray area.
But there are some things, particularly if, for example, you're working on an investigation or something at the Department of Justice and you want to make sure that the stuff doesn't get out. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
How do you handle the timing of that sort of thing?
Well, there are exemptions for matters that are in litigation, matters that are matters of strategy, matters that are internal communications in certain offices. So there certainly are. We're very respectful of those types of exemptions in the public records laws. So, for example, when my office is working on a criminal investigation, those certainly are not documents that would be subject to disclosure at that time, but they could be later after the
once
case
it's no
concludes.
Longer an issue.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. In fact, I worked on a case that I won in 1976 that was on that very issue of what happens when criminal investigative records are when the investigation concludes.
And is it when it concludes, or is there a buffer time after when it concludes?
It's essentially when it concludes, when it's all over. And then, of course, there's some factors to consider in terms of confidentiality, privacy, and such.
Ellen Rosenblum, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Oregon's Attorney General. Join us at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So when we talk about emails, it gets into the larger issue of public records. And I believe you've set up a task force to look at...
We're just in the early stages of setting up a task force. That's correct. And we'll be working closely with other state agencies, with the governor's office, to set up with the media We hope to have a very broad coalition of individuals and organizations that will participate with us. This is really important, and it's been a while since we've really taken a good look at our public records laws.
We had a fair number of chats during Sunshine Week back in March about public records and the general state of affairs, and it seems like the general trend is that there'll be a burst of activity when people realize things need to be public, and then over the course of the next few years, particularly state legislatures seem to chip away by putting exemptions into law. And does that seem to be what has happened in Oregon?
Well, we have a lot of exemptions, hundreds. However, we also have a pretty robust public records law here in Oregon, and we are regularly disclosing records, you know, thousands and thousands, if not millions and millions of records throughout the course of the year. So I think the law works, but definitely need to take a look in a few areas. One is the cost, especially, nobody should be required to spend a lot of money in order to get basic records that they're entitled to. On the other hand, it can be a very onerous task for, say, a local jurisdiction that's a request made to. So cost issues, timeliness issues, obviously for the media, timeliness is everything. And so we need to be quicker. And there have been some, I think, legitimate criticisms of the timeliness issues with respect to the Kitzhaber investigation records. And then, of course, the exemptions. There are lots and lots of exemptions. But, you know, there's always going to be room for more. There may be need for an additional exemption that no one has thought of. For example, we had a request recently from what looked like a foreign country for records. We had a request recently for records that looked like they were really just trying to fish for opportunities to sell things to government employees. You have to wonder whether there shouldn't be exemptions for those kinds of situations, because we do need to protect the privacy of our employees, of state employees. So there's a fine line there. There are certainly some good reasons for the exemptions that we have, but we need to take a look, and perhaps some of them don't need to be there any longer.
I imagine the task force won't be able to report to this legislature and get any legislation through.
This task force will not be reporting to this legislature. However, there are a number of bills that are on the table at this legislature that are being brought by several legislators and by the governor.
Okay. Things that would open up the laws, deal with things like timelines, costs.
Exactly. Well, I think so, yes. I haven't studied them that carefully. They're brand new, just pretty much hot off the press during the past week. But there are some good ideas, I think, coming forth, some of which could probably be addressed even more quickly than our task force recommendations.
So you're about three-quarters of the way through your term. Is the job what you thought it would be? Are you going to run again next year?
I have announced that I am going to run again for a second term. I love this job. I can't imagine a better way to serve the public with the background that I have had as a lawyer and a judge. And so I would look forward to the chance to serve for another term. Whether the job is exactly what I'd imagine, probably not, if you think about it. No one would have thought that I'd be, for example, suing a multi-billion-dollar company for screwing up our health exchange website. Certainly would never have imagined that there could be an investigation of a now former governor. There's just lots of things that could not have been imagined. But I'll tell you, this is a really important job because you're constantly able to do things to protect our most vulnerable citizens, the consumer protection aspects, the privacy, online privacy issues, the protecting children and families. Right here in this area, we have two offices that work very hard day in and day out to protect families and children. So I'm really proud of the work that we do at the department, and I'd love to keep doing it given the opportunity.
Ellen Rosenblum, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Attorney General of the State of Oregon. Thank you so much for coming by.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.